Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS 89.5 FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, we've got a really interesting show for you today. It's called Facebook, Public Schools, and Free Speech. Three things that, well, they don't always seem to go together and seem to be of great interest to many of our listeners, from teachers and principals on the one side to students on the other. And let me just give you a hint. They don't always see eye to eye on the interrelationship between those three things. Now, we actually have a very interesting interview, a lengthy interview with a fellow by the name of Frank Lomonti, who specializes in school law, specifically press freedom and with regard to schools, public schools, colleges, that sort of thing. It's such a good interview that it's going to span two episodes. So this is just going to be part one of our interview with Frank. But even before we get to Frank, we have an unrelated, but I think you'll agree, a very interesting interview with a fellow by the name of Michael Perry. And the reason we're putting it at the beginning of this episode and running it when we are is because this involves an upcoming event. Michael Perry is a law professor at Emory University, and he's been invited by King College's Buechner Institute to come quite soon now, actually, and give a presentation, several presentations throughout over a day or two this week, culminating with a presentation on Monday evening, February the 4th, at 7 p.m. in the Bristol Public Library. And in just a moment here, I'll be talking to Michael about this. I'm going to encourage everybody who can hear this, everybody who's within driving range of Bristol, Virginia, to go over to the public library and hear Michael, because he's a fascinating fellow. He's got lots to say, and there'll be a very extensive question and answer period. In fact, Michael's told me that he likes the questions and the answers better than any other part of his presentation. So I think everyone who goes will enjoy it. So without further ado, Michael Perry of Emory University, and then we'll get to Facebook. Well, Michael Perry of Emory University, who the heck are you and what do you do?
Well, Stuart, I'm a professor of law at Emory University in my 10th year at Emory. Most of my career was spent in Chicago at Northwestern University. And my specialties are United States constitutional law, human rights, and law and religion. And they're all related in one way or another, but those are the things I love to teach and love to write about.
Well, that is a lot of territory that you cover. The particular reason that we're talking to you today is because you have agreed to make a presentation here in our region, in Appalachia, at King College, specifically the Buechner Institute. And I believe that's going to be on Monday, February the 4th, in the Bristol Public Library at 7 p.m. So I'm going to ask you, what are you going to be talking about for the Buechner Institute?
Well, let me say that I am so delighted and honored to be coming to King College, to the Buechner Institute, to speak to folks there. It won't be my first time. I've been there, I think, twice before to speak to the students and faculty. Mm-hmm. So I'm familiar with King and have a lot of admiration for the school.
It's a wonderful institution, and it's a beautiful institution, too.
Yes, it is. And this time, I'm going to be speaking about a couple of related subjects. I'm going to be talking about the human right to religious freedom, although, as I'm going to explain in my lecture, the human right is not a right just to religious freedom, but to religious and moral freedom. So, for example, if somebody were claiming conscientious objection to the war, we typically wouldn't say, well, we're not going to take you seriously unless you're a theist. We'll take the claim seriously even if the person is not a theist or not self-identify as religious, but is quite sincerely and fundamentally a matter of moral conscience and moral conviction. So I'm going to be talking about the human right to religious and moral freedom. And more concretely, I'm going to be talking about the implications of that right for the controversy over same-sex marriage.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be a controversial topic, but I'm looking forward to discussing it with people.
I don't know, Michael. I don't think that's a particularly hot button issue.
Yes, well, probably more controversial in some areas than in others. But in any event, I'm. I guess the way I put it is I'm going to pursue the implications of the right to religious and moral freedom for the controversy over same-sex marriage. In particular, I'm going to address the question whether a state's refusal to grant access to civil marriage is consistent with the right to religious and moral freedom.
Civil marriage, not civil unions, but actual civil marriage.
No, it's a civil marriage. That's right. I'm talking about the California, for example, is perhaps you know, grants civil union status to qualifying same-sex couples, and as a matter of the law, it's pretty much equivalent to marriage in terms of the legal benefits and privileges and responsibilities and so forth. But nonetheless, there's a huge controversy out there, as many of your listeners will know, about whether the state of California is required under its own constitution or under the, now it's before the Supreme Court, under the federal constitution to, as long as it's in the business of bestowing the honorific term marriage on some couples, on heterosexual couples, whether it's obligated somehow to bestow that honorific on same-sex couples as well.
Right. And of course, that does seem to be the flashpoint. I mean, even states that are willing to give pretty much equivalent civil unions are, as you point out, reluctant to actually use the M word and to call it marriage.
Well, it has been a more dramatic step for states to do that, or more controversial about whether they should do that. But if you look at the map, it seems to be the case that a lot of states that made that first step towards granting civil union status to qualifying same-sex couples, a number of them are now making the next step. And if I'm not mistaken, Illinois, where I taught for 15 years, it's on the verge of taking that second step. In any event, those who oppose the people who are most enthusiastic and most vigorous in their opposition to these developments, they're not focused so much on the distinction between civil union status and marital status. They're fundamentally opposed to taking even the first step of the civil union status. So my religious tradition, for example, it has been Roman Catholic, and the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, it's not that they say we're okay with civil union status, we just don't think that it should be called marriage. They oppose even granting civil union status to same-sex couples.
Yeah, that's going to be a very big issue, and it's one that has been the subject of several episodes of this show in the past and will probably be.
Oh, how about that?
Oh, well, it's unavoidable these days. In fact, one of my guests called it sort of the constitutional issue for our era, and I'd be hard-pressed to find something that's generating more interest and more passion, no pun intended.
At least since Obamacare was upheld by the Supreme Court.
You know, you're right. That was a huge issue, and of course, we spent a lot of time on health care, too. But I don't think that it has generated quite the level of interest.
The interesting thing about the controversy, and it'll be interesting for me to see whether this holds true at King College, because I'll be speaking during the day to the students and faculty and then to members of the community at the library in the evening. It'll be interesting to see if what I'm about to say holds true there, which is, the issue is largely not controversial among the younger generation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I realize that there are areas of the country where it's going to be relatively controversial even among young people. But if you, as I'm sure you know, the polling data shows that the issue is much, much less contested. It's almost a non-issue among younger people, so that with respect to, say, the issue of abortion, that continues to be a very controversial issue among all segments of the population. Even, what is it, this is the
40 years.
40 years since the 1973 decision in Roe versus Wade. But I think it's fairly safe to say that 10 or 20 years from now, there's going to be little opposition to granting access to civil marriage to same-sex couples.
It has been striking, you know, having lived through the last 40 years or so, it's been striking how radically and rapidly attitudes in society have changed with regard to gay rights generally.
Right.
And specifically,
right.
I mean, you know, back in the 1970s, many people wouldn't even talk about the issue.
Oh, no. It's and I'm 67 years old, and of course, in my lifetime, I've seen the most fundamental kind of shift with respect to that issue. What's interesting is I was born and raised in an Irish Catholic family. What's interesting is that among the, not the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, but among the sisters, the Catholic sisters, one of whom is my aunt, Aunt Betty, a Dominican sister who's in her mid-80s, and among a lot of the older priests, the Vatican II era priests, they are among the most supportive of this new tolerance for sexual minorities. But the institutional church in the hierarchy is very much traditionalist in its attitude.
You know, that's interesting. I've been reading about that. I was not raised in the Catholic faith, and so I'm definitely an outsider when it comes to this. But I've actually, my understanding is that what you say is generally true, that by and large there is, I hesitate to use the word schism, but there's a great divide between the generally male hierarchy in the church and certainly the people in Rome on the one hand, and the generally female nuns, of course, in the United States.
That's true, but it is also the case that because the bishops in the United States are appointed by the Vatican, it's not surprising that the people who are appointed, the great predominance of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, reflect the attitudes of the magisterium of mm-hmm. the Pope and the cardinals of the church, so that what that means is that the hierarchy in the United States is very relatively uniform in defending the traditionalist view defended by the Vatican. But once you move down into the pews, it's really quite a different matter. And in fact, let me point out to you that in this last election, you may know that in Maryland and in Washington State, the pro-gay marriage forces won in those elections, mm-hmm. in those referenda. The issues were different in each state. But the interesting thing is that for all of the opposition of the institutional church, the Catholic governor of Maryland and the Catholic governor of Washington State were on the pro-gay marriage side. So that's a pretty dramatic illustration of the divide between the hierarchy and the pews.
Well, it seems that the Catholic Church, at least in the United States, is anything but monolithic.
That's right. And, of course, King College is as you know, it's affiliated with the Presbyterian Church USA, and the PCUSA has, over the last generation, been struggling with this issue itself. Although I think it's fair to say that that's a much more pluralistic institution in terms of its leadership with respect to that issue than the hierarchy of the Catholic Church is. Hmm. They're pretty uniform with respect to the issue.
Well, Michael, we've talked a lot about the religious aspect of it, but you emphasized at the outset that you're not just talking about religious rights, but moral rights. Now,
well, that's right. And so much that we've talked about so far, of course, I have no particular expertise, the kind of sociology of the issue. My interest is in understanding as carefully as I can what the internationally recognized human right to religious and moral freedom is, and then pursuing as rigorously as I can the implications of that right, of that internationally recognized human right, for this controversy.
Well, I have to challenge your premise. I mean, is there one standard? Right.
Well, yes, that's actually you certainly don't want me to go into the details, but if you look, there's something called the International Covenant mm-hmm. on Civil and Political Rights, and 167 countries of the 193 members of the United Nations are parties to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, including as of the summer of 1992, under the final summer in which the senior President Bush was in office before he was defeated by Bill Clinton. The United States actually, the Senate actually ratified that treaty. We've been a party since 1992. The International Covenant is a treaty, unlike the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it is an elaboration of the rights in the Universal Declaration. If you look at the Article 18 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is the right that I'm concerned with, you'll see that it is explicitly a right to religious and moral freedom. So that's not a controversial interpretation of the right. That's just a reading of what the right itself is on the face of it. Moreover, the Human Rights Committee, which is the body charged with adjudicating cases that arise under the International Covenant, has also made that clear. And then when you look at the jurisprudence, say, of the Supreme Court of Canada, which incorporates this right in its own constitution, they've been very emphatic that it's a right to moral conscience as well as religious conscience. So that piece of it I'll explain to the audience, but that's not a particularly controversial proposition.
That's very interesting. So, and
there is a Stuart, there is a very interesting question here, since I'm not talking about the constitutional controversy in the United States. Although in my work, I won't be at King. In my work, I ask the question, to what extent, if any, is this internationally recognized right to religious and moral freedom actually embedded or recognized in the constitutional law of the United States? That's an interesting question, and I think a very strong argument can be made that the right to the free exercise of religion, which is an American constitutional right, properly interpreted, would yield a right that is very close, essentially identical to the right to religious and moral freedom. But that's a more controversial proposition, and the argument supporting that would be a little technical for a non-lawyer or law school audience.
Yeah, and correct on both counts. It is technical and it is controversial. But interestingly enough, of course, as you know, Article 6 of the Constitution tells us that if a ratified treaty is part of the highest law of the land, right?
Well, that's right. But this gets into another technical area. Mm-hmm. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights is not what is called an international. Here in the United States, it's not a self-executing treaty.
Ah, okay.
So what that means is that no one could bring a suit in the United States based directly on that treaty. That treaty is not a part of domestic law in the way it would be if it were, quote, a self-executing treaty. So often when the Senate ratifies a treaty, it will obligate the United States to respect the treaty under international law, but the treaty provisions won't themselves become a part of domestic law such that they could serve as the basis of litigation in a domestic suit.
Mm-hmm. It'd require some sort of enabling legislation.
You're not going to see anyone trying to argue in a civil case that the government is required to grant access to civil marriage on the basis of its ratification of this treaty.
In any case, as we like to say around here, that horse done left the barn because it was ratified 20 years ago.
Yeah, but again, ratified, but its status is non-self-executing, mm-hmm. which means that even though we've ratified it, the treaty cannot serve as the basis of a lawsuit in a domestic lawsuit, basis of a domestic lawsuit.
Well, I think I follow you.
I know that's kind of technical, but we're not going to worry about
sometimes
that.
Sometimes law gets technical, but the basic issue, which we started with and which we'll return to, is that you're trying to figure out what this individual religious and moral freedom is. And
that's right, and I'd like to get away from the controversy about what the courts are doing or should be doing. Mm-hmm. I think that to some extent that's a distraction because that's a controversy all its own. How large or small a role we want the courts to play in American society. You know, we can argue about that in the context of the constitutional challenge to Obamacare. We can argue about that in the context of suits trying to compel states to grant access to civil marriage to same-sex couples. But that's a separate issue. What I want to say is, if we take seriously, we, the citizens of the United States, and the lawmakers who represent us, if we take seriously this human right to religious and moral freedom, what then are the implications of this right for the way we think about the question whether states should grant access to civil marriage to same-sex couples?
Have you reached a conclusion that you'd care to share with us, or the?
Well, I think what I'll do is, if it's okay with you, Stuart, I think I'll leave that much unclear so that the audience at King College will have something to look forward to.
Yeah, so it's like a movie trailer. We have to keep them wondering how it's going to turn out in the end, so that they'll come and see you. I'm curious. Are you going to have questions and answers at the end
Absolutely.
Of your session?
Absolutely. As I understand the format. In the evening at the library, there's going to be a lot of time for Q&A. Mm-hmm. So I am certainly looking forward to that. And in fact, in that format, it may be less important what I say in a lecture sense than that I say a few things to get the audience excited and engaged, and then I can say what I have to say in response to questions that they ask.
Well,
so
I agree.
It should be a lot of fun.
Oh, I agree with you in that respect, and I agree with you also that it's always, whenever I make a presentation, I think the questions and answers are always the most pleasant part of it, because that's when you really get to address exactly what the audience wants to hear.
Wonderful. Well put.
So That's what we're going to say. We're going to encourage everybody to go down to the Bristol Public Library at 7 o'clock this coming Monday, February the 4th, so you can go see the Buechner Institute lecture, featuring Michael Perry of Emory University, talking about human rights and religious freedoms and same-sex marriage, all kinds of interesting, thought-provoking stuff. So, Michael Perry, thanks very much for talking with us.
Stuart, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for making time for this.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I've just had a very interesting conversation with Michael Perry of the Emory University School of Law. And just a reminder, Michael's going to be speaking on behalf of the Buechner Institute of King College this coming Monday, February the 4th at 7 p.m. in the Bristol Public Library. And I realize, in fact, Wayne, my producer, has just told me that the rebroadcast of this show on WETS will be one day after Michael's presentation. I apologize for you local listeners on that day, but all you Sunday listeners and all the people who hear this beforehand, please get over and hear Michael. Go to his presentation, Bristol Public Library, 7 p.m. on Monday, February the 4th. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll start talking to Frank Lomonti about Facebook, public schools, and free speech. Stick around.
Facebook is a crime when people have too much time sending me requests, IQ and brain tests. It's no fucking joke. I don't like to super poke. Scrabulous hotness, update my status. I'm getting bored of Facebook, so don't invite me, for a sheep will bite me. Please don't hurt me, give me your graffiti. Hot or not, so what? I don't wanna know. Movie quiz, sex quiz, stupid Johnny Depp quiz. Family Guy, which one?
Well, it's that time again for our constitutional quiz, and on the line with me is our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael. How are you, Kelly?
I am well. How are you, Stuart?
Doing extremely well. Now, I understand you have a little one with you, and that her name, well, I'm not going to say her name on the radio unless you want to, but at any rate, she's...
Okay. It's okay. Our little Madeline is now 2 months old.
2 months old, so you're definitely the quiz mom now, and Madeline may actually be joining us somewhat unexpectedly later, right?
She's asleep right now, but you never know. She has a little onesie that says "We the People," so she gets into this constitutional conversation stuff.
Well, let's hope there's not too much "We" in the "We the People," because then she might wake up.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, who's our contestant today?
Yeah, Derek Harris from Lexington, Kentucky.
All the way from Lexington, Kentucky. Well, that's just tremendous. We appreciate your being with us, Derek. Are you ready for a really tough question?
Yes, I am.
Well, you'll probably do fine, because I think motherhood has softened the quiz lady. She used to be very she used to be very hard on contestants, but maybe she'll throw you a softball today. So, okay, quiz mom, what's the first question?
All right, Derek. The question is, a warrant is required in order to search what? And the answer choices are A, a house for a suspected stolen property, B, during a routine traffic violation stop, C, a student's locker at a public school, or D, when an illegal substance is in plain view.
Oh, my goodness. So we've got four different circumstances, and the question is, which one of these would require a warrant?
I would have to go with A.
Yeah, I'm going to go with, well, what was A again?
A was a house for suspected stolen property.
And you think that's the answer, Derek?
I think that's the answer.
Okay, well, why not the other ones? What was B?
B was during a routine traffic violation stop.
You don't think you need a warrant for that one, Derek?
Unless they're going to search your car and you don't give them permission, I think they would need a warrant then.
You sound like you speak from experience.
No, I just have no people.
Oh, he's stumbling a little bit here.
Yeah, I think there's a little hesitation there. What was what was answer choice C?
C, a student's locker at a public school.
What about that one, Derek?
I wouldn't go with that one because I think that since it's on school grounds, they would have a right to search it.
Yeah, I think I remember principals coming pretty aggressive in some of those lockers. I don't think they all had warrants. I mean, you might be right on that one. Okay, what was D then?
D, when an illegal substance is in plain view.
You think they need a warrant for something in plain view, Derek?
No, because then they would have probable cause.
Ooh, he sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So we can't dissuade you. You're going to stick with answer choice A, are you?
I think I'm going to stick with A, yes, sir.
Well, Kelly, what do you say? Is he correct or not?
Congratulations.
Yay,
well,
Derek, tremendous. Derek, very good analysis, and we tried really hard to trip you up, and you just wouldn't bite, would you?
Nope.
Okay, well, you win a T-shirt, and thank you very much for playing our constitutional quiz.
All right, thank you all very much.
All right, bye-bye.
A student in Florida just won a $1 settlement. She sued her former high school principal for violating her First Amendment right, her freedom of speech. She basically went on Facebook back in 2008, and she posted that her AP English teacher was the worst teacher that she's ever had.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That sounds like such an Anna Kasparian statement.
Yeah.
So worst ever.
And I would totally write something like that on Facebook, right?
Yeah.
So apparently that got back to her AP English teacher, it got back to the principal, and they decided that they wanted to suspend her because of cyberbullying. So she's like, not having that.
That's crazy. You can't cyberbully your teacher unless you say, look, I'm going to come out there with a stick. Right?
Right.
But it's just saying she sucks.
Right.
I'm not allowed to write that on my own personal Facebook? That's crazy, dog.
That is crazy. So what ended up happening is, first of all, the principal tried to throw the case out, saying that it's illegitimate, this and that. But the judge said, no, her freedom of speech is protected under the Constitution, so we're going to go ahead with the court proceedings. And then the principal decided to settle. He paid $5,000.
No, $15,000.
I'm sorry, $15,000. For the legal fees, and then an additional $1 for the student.
No.
But the most important part of this case is she wanted the principal to clear her academic record,
right.
And he did so.
All right, there's so many great little things in here. First of all, I love Katie Evans because, look, I hate the frivolous lawsuits, right? And we rail against them on the show all the time. Here's a case where, look, I think she was right to protect that freedom of speech, and she didn't do it for money. She took $1. That's the part I love, right? She just wanted to make a point, and she did. Fantastic, right? Number two, Katie, you don't have to worry about your permanent record. Nobody gives a damn.
I know, seriously. I was like, oh, they keep that? What happens with that permanent record?
Oh, they used to scare us with that all the time in high school, because I used to get in trouble all the time. They're like, oh, that goes on your permanent record. And I'm now a grown-ass man, and I got to be honest with you. That permanent record has never come out in any given. It's not like I went for a job opening at the age of 32, and they're like, on the other hand, on your permanent record.
All right.
Okay, it said that you bad-mouthed somebody on Facebook that was a teacher. So everybody comes out looking bad here, and when they suspended her, they actually did the teacher, Sarah Phelps, harm too, because now then everybody's talking about what a crappy teacher she is.
Right.
But in fact, we find out that on Facebook, or no.
RateMyProfessor.com, which is one of my favorite websites. Even though I'm not going to school anymore, I still go back.
Oh,
and
really? Random and slightly bitter. Okay. In this case, it's RateMyTeachers.com, because it's high school, right?
Right.
She actually has a 3.9 out of 5.0. That's
Which
not bad.
Which isn't bad. It isn't bad at all.
Okay.
I'm guessing that Katie Evans was bitter about a grade. And it was an AP English class. You could tell she's an overachiever, so she probably got an A- instead of an A, and she freaked out. Katie Evans sounds like me.
I was going to say, totally sounds like Anna.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now it's time for us to talk about Facebook, public schools, and free speech. And we have a real treat for you. We have an interesting lengthy interview with a fellow by the name of Frank Lomonti, who's the executive director of the Student Press Law Center, which is a nonprofit legal aid organization that serves the needs of student journalists all over the nation. Frank actually contacted me a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, there's an anniversary coming up. We're about to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Hazelwood decision. And as you'll find out here shortly, the Hazelwood decision is one of only a handful of cases decided by the United States Supreme Court dealing with the issues of student press freedom. You know, those guys at the high school you used to go to ran the student paper. Do they have any First Amendment rights, or can the school control what they put into the paper? Well, as we're going to discuss here in just a second, that's actually a very complicated question with lots of different things to be balanced. And the Supreme Court, well, let's just say it hasn't always been consistent in its rulings. Well, Frank Lomonti, welcome to your weekly Constitutional.
Thanks for having me, Stuart. It's a great show.
Yeah, thank you so much. Who are you and what do you do?
I'm an attorney and in a former life was a journalist before that. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization called the Student Press Law Center. The Student Press Law Center has been around for 39 years. It's based in Arlington, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., and it's a source of information and research and advocacy supporting people who work in and around the student media in high schools, colleges, all the way up to grad school.
High schools, colleges, and grad school, but nothing below that. No middle schools or elementary schools?
We'll get a call occasionally from somebody in middle school, and we'll teach workshops there if we're asked to. But generally, the legal issues that are arising in high schools and in colleges. We run the gamut of issues from censorship and First Amendment issues to access to public meetings and public records. And we have a free attorney hotline where we take about 2,000 inquiries from students around the country every year.
Okay, and given your background and given the name of your organization, I'm guessing that by and large you are fighting censorship and trying to assure access and freedom of the press for student publications.
We are. The founding mission of the organization when it was set up back in 1974 was really as a civic engagement organization. The whole idea behind the SPLC was to empower students and encourage students to get involved in the civic life of their community through journalism as a vehicle. The notion was that, you know, journalism is really the way that a lot of young people engage for the first time with their government, the first time that they figure out there's a county commission, there's a school board, and there's a court system that actually has an impact on my daily life and on my rights, and I have ways of accessing those systems and having an influence on them.
Well, that's very interesting. In fact, it's kind of funny you should mention that because it just occurred to me. My very first interaction with our political system was back when I was in high school, and there was a local tax issue that was on the ballot back in my hometown in Michigan. And that was the first time I attended a school board meeting. It was the first time I did any public advocacy on any issue at all. And I certainly did learn a lot.
Sure, and mine as well. I can tell you the same story about going to a school board meeting when I was a 15-year-old kid back in Gainesville, Florida, and meeting with the school superintendent in his office and interviewing him about the budget. And, it was the first time that you open your eyes and see that there's a much bigger world out there beyond your school building that sets policy and that impacts on your life and that you can have a voice in.
Right. Well, you beat me, Frank. You were there as a 15-year-old. I was probably close to 18 before I got involved. But okay, I'll give you that one. Now, this is very interesting that you should mention Gainesville because, of course, you have an absolutely wonderful College of Journalism there at the University of Florida. Was that where you went to college?
I was the editor of the University of Florida newspaper when I was there, the Alligator. I still talk with folks down there and help them with the occasional controversy that they have.
This is like old home week. Now, did you know a guy named Lowenstein?
Ralph Lowenstein, sure, yeah, was the dean of journalism during most of the time I was there, yeah.
He was an expert witness in a case I had some years ago.
Ah,
absolutely wonderful fellow. We'll have to talk about him sometime.
Yeah.
Okay, well, at any rate, so you're a journalist, you're a lawyer, you believe in the First Amendment, you believe in student speech. Let me sketch a little bit of the constitutional background here for our listeners, and you feel free to jump in as you wish. But, you know, we have this thing called the First Amendment. It says, by and large, that Congress shall pass no law restricting freedom of speech or of the press. And it doesn't, you know, it's not limited. It doesn't say it doesn't apply to anybody. It does not apply to students, or it does not apply to children. And so children, students, do have, you know, from the get-go, some kind of free speech rights pursuant to the First Amendment. And student press has some kind of First Amendment rights. On the other hand, especially the younger you get, and that's why I asked that question about middle school and elementary school, the younger you get, the more we have a countervailing concern about properly educating children, properly supervising them. You know, we don't let kids say anything they want to as parents or as school teachers or whatever. So those are the two competing interests, aren't they?
Sure, that's absolutely right, and that is the quandary for policymakers, it is the dilemma for judges, and it's something that people like myself who work as advocates always have to keep in mind, is that as the Supreme Court has told us time and time again, that all constitutional rights have to be viewed through the prism of the school environment, and you often have to make sacrifices and compromises in the level of rights that a person would have walking down the street in the real world. I mean, I think it's important that you mentioned at the outset that a young person, a student, a minor, has all the benefits of the Bill of Rights when they're walking down the sidewalk on their own time, right? So it's not like we would ever countenance the idea that the police could yank you into a police car, throw you in a holding cell, question you without a lawyer for days on end, without presenting you with a charge or giving you a court hearing or letting you have an opportunity to respond, right? We all know that the Fourth Amendment would prohibit that kind of behavior, whether the person is 6 years old or 60 years old. So in your civilian life outside of school or outside of college, you've got the full benefit of the Bill of Rights no matter how old you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question becomes, when you go inside of the gates of the institution or you're engaging in some kind of a function that's affiliated with the institution, maybe you're playing on a sports team or you're on a field trip or you're otherwise under the supervision of the institution, how much of your rights should you be asked to sacrifice in the name of good order and institutional control, and also protecting the rights of the people on the other side? We know that in the school setting, especially where you have a mandatory attendance law, you're not allowed to drop out of school, you're required to be there, and so to some extent, the people who are listening are a captive listening audience, too. If I get up in front of a school assembly and I start spewing out a stream of four-letter words, I'm exposing a bunch of listeners who have no choice but to be there. They can't get up and walk away and leave. So we make compromises in the First Amendment in light of that kind of a captive audience setting.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Frank Lomonti about Facebook, public schools, and free speech. Now let's take a Madison Minute.
Our Bill of Rights is one of the most cherished parts of our Constitution. It may therefore surprise you to learn that many of the founders of our nation, including James Madison, the father of the Constitution himself, initially opposed the adoption of a Bill of Rights. These founders had their reasons for opposing a Bill of Rights, but other founders, notably George Mason and Patrick Henry, considered one to be essential, and enough founders agreed with Mason and Henry that they came close to preventing the ratification of the Constitution because it lacked a Bill of Rights. Eventually, a deal was struck. The Constitution would be ratified, and the first order of business would be the drafting of a Bill of Rights. Once this deal was struck, the actual drafting was a matter of much less controversy. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. After the break, we'll come back and find out what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll speak some more with Frank Lomonti of the Student Press Law Center. Stick around.
I just got another Facebook friend online. This brings my total to 185. My wife, she only has Amiga 82, so I tell her I'm more popular than you. So how come I feel so lonely? Hundreds of virtual friends. I am so popular on Facebook, popular.
Well, Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, this week, actually, we're going on the road to Colonial Williamsburg, where we are going to be hosting our, as you know, your favorite time of the year, Stuart, our We the People State Finals.
I am so excited. I'm going to judge there, and I love We the People, and I love judging We the People, and I love the Virginia State Finals, and I really love Colonial Williamsburg. This is like a quadfecta.
I know, for us constitutional nerds, we and the history nerds, we are so excited to host the Virginia State Finals in Colonial Williamsburg this year.
Oh, I bet. Now, is this actually going to be in the old section, or is it, there's probably some facility nearby where we...
There's a conference facility right next to the Visitor Center at Colonial Williamsburg that we'll be using, but the students who are attending will certainly have the opportunity to go see the historic site. In addition to compete, more importantly, competing on their knowledge of the Constitution.
Absolutely. Now, just for our listeners' benefit, I know the answer to this question, but who is involved here? Is it just high school or middle school or what?
That's a great question. We have the high school teams will be compete from all across the state will be competing on Friday, February 15th, and then the middle school kids will be competing on Saturday, February 16th. And I shouldn't say kids, because really, these middle school and high school students are just scholars. They're really incredible students and have taken their knowledge level to the next level of understanding.
They are absolutely remarkable. In fact, I like them both, but the ones I think I like the most are probably the middle schoolers, because it's so remarkable, especially when you see some kid up there who's, you know, maybe barely 11 or 12 years old. And he just spews out this remarkable knowledge. It's striking.
You and John Locke and
it's astonishing. Well, we're looking forward to it, Kelly, and I'll see you there.
I'll see you there, and Madeline will be there as well, wearing her We the People onesie.
It is now a fivefecta, a quintfecta. I am so excited. Thanks,
baby,
Kelly.
Baby Madeline, you got it.
All right, bye.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now let's continue our conversation with Frank Lomonte, who is the Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Now, this is a nonprofit legal aid organization, and it serves the need of student journalists nationwide. Frank is a really good person to talk to about the lengthy and somewhat tortured Supreme Court history of student press freedom. Right now, we're talking about some of the various competing interests that the court considers when it encounters one of these cases.
So there's several competing interests here. And just to cross our T's and dot our I's, I think we should emphasize also that when we talk about the First Amendment or any constitutional protections, we have to remember the concept of government action. Most of the schools that our children are going to are branches of the state. They are public schools, and therefore they are run by the local governments, which are part of the state governments. And that's how the First Amendment kicks in. So whereas my children don't have any First Amendment right when I tell them to go to bed and be quiet at home. If a school teacher starts silencing my children in school, and if that school teacher is a public school teacher and a representative of the state, that's when the First Amendment kicks in.
Sure, absolutely. And normally the way that we see a First Amendment case arise, normally the way that it gets to court, is the school has somehow taken away a privilege or a benefit or has imposed a punishment or a sanction, and you raise the First Amendment as a defense. That's how a case gets into court. And frankly, right, that's how almost all constitutional cases get to court. It's rarely the case that you're using the Bill of Rights or you're using the Constitution as a sword. You're usually using it as a shield. You're using it as a defense to say the government cannot do to me what it is trying to do to me, or that the government acted wrongfully and overextended and overstepped itself in doing what it just did to me. That might be suspension, it might be expulsion, it might be exclusion from an athletic team or some other kind of a privilege or perk of student status.
Okay, well, let's try to do this as chronologically as we can, because the law in this area, as you know, has changed a lot over the years. So pick whatever starting point you think is best, and why don't we talk about what the Supreme Court and perhaps other federal courts have said about whether and to what extent students have a First Amendment right in public schools?
Sure. Well, the landmark from which most people measure the First Amendment in schools goes back to 1969, when dinosaurs roamed the earth. And, at that time, as if you put yourself back in historical context, we were sort of winding down the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, and there was a lot of unrest on college campuses that was trickling its way down to high schools and even middle schools. And the Supreme Court decided a case called Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District. And it was just exactly that type of case we just talked about, where a school imposes or threatens disciplinary sanctions, and the speaker believes that this has been done wrongfully based on the content of their speech. In that case, it was a group of high school and middle school students who were Quakers, who were members of the Society of Friends along with their family, who were conscientious objectors to the war in Vietnam and wanted to wear black armbands into their public schools in order to display their anti-war sentiment, in order to protest the war. Well, the school enacted a no armbands policy and told them that they were banned from returning to school as long as they insisted on engaging in this protest. The students, asserting their First Amendment rights, challenged that exclusion in court.
But that's all they were doing. They were just showing up at school with a black armband on. That was it.
Absolutely.
There was no protest other than that.
Right. It was a silent and peaceful protest. And that became critical to the court's resolution of the case in 1969. Justice Fortas wrote an opinion that really is one of the many great works of literature that the Supreme Court has put forth. It's one where if you're just having a really bad day at work, or you're feeling particularly cynical or downcast, and you want to feel inspired about America again, pick up Justice Abe Fortas's decision in Tinker versus Des Moines, and it's really quite inspiring. He talks about how freedom is hazardous, and he even uses that word hazardous in the opinion, but that our national interests say that we must take the risk of the hazards of freedom so that we can prepare people to be full participants in their democracy. And he warns that the state, if it's left unchecked without sufficient governance on its authority, is going to turn schools into what he calls enclaves of totalitarianism, and that it will use its authority to program students with a message of compliance to the government. And so,
yeah, that was actually the real thrust of his opinion, if I recall it correctly, was that, you know, this is, we're supposed to be teaching people how to be good citizens here, among many other, you know, we teach them algebra, we teach them physics, we teach them chemistry, all these other things, but we're also supposed to be teaching them to be good citizens, and we don't teach them to be good citizens by shutting them up.
Very much so, and what he recognized in the opinion was that that participatory kind of learning, being a part of the back and forth of the national dialogue of issues of the day, was what school was about. It wasn't a distraction from school. It wasn't a diversion from school. It was school. and he really he embraced that idea that no, the school ought not marginalize discussion of issues like Vietnam. It ought to wrap its arms tightly around discussion of issues. If you've got a political issue that is motivating and challenging and engaging to young people, that's an issue that ought to be front and center in the public school.
And what was that famous?
So it was a terrific opinion.
What was that famous line he said?
The fact that these students had a First Amendment right to engage in that act of silent political protest.
Okay, and what was that famous line he said? You don't leave the Constitution at the schoolhouse gate?
At the schoolhouse gate, right.
Right. In fact, I'm willing to bet you've got that pasted on the wall right above your computer screen, don't you?
Well, and we can talk about this later, but of course what's so interesting now, and one of the issues that the courts are really wrestling and struggling with, is does that schoolhouse gate swing in both directions? Because in Justice Fortas's day, in the 60s, Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet. So we were at a time when we were still talking about speech taking place in a paper newspaper or on an armband or on a leaflet, and the idea that speech might take place on Facebook or on Twitter was beyond anyone's contemplation. But now that's the First Amendment issue that the federal courts are most visibly struggling with.
We'll get to that one in a minute. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Before we leave Tinker, let's just acknowledge that this was a late Warren Court decision. Warren Court being basically the court from the 50s and 60s that plowed so much new ground and created so many more individual rights concepts. And it was generally acknowledged to be a fairly left-leaning court, fairly pro-plaintiff, fairly pro-individual rights. And this was the high watermark of school press freedom. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's always been my sense.
It very much was. It was one of the last hurrahs of the Warren Court, actually. And it certainly does represent the most kind of forceful enunciation of student rights ever by the Supreme Court, or really by any court.
Okay, and that very same year, 1969, was the first year of Richard Nixon's first administration. And he had run on a platform of picking more conservative federal judges, more law and order type judges. And gradually, the federal judiciary started moving in a much more conservative direction. So how did that impact the law of the student press?
Right. Well, so the composition of the court changes, and Chief Justice Berger takes over and leads the court in a more conservative law and order kind of direction. And you see Chief Justice Berger's influence on a lot of cases. The general drift is more toward deference to the exercise of official authority. You see that in cases involving interactions between police and citizens in things like the search and seizure context, and you certainly see that in working its way through the First Amendment jurisprudence as well. Most notable example in the student speech case is a case called the Frazier case, Bethel School District versus Matthew Frazier.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about that case a little bit if you want.
Sure. That, yeah. What year was the Frazier case?
That was a 1986 ruling, so that was 2 years before the Supreme Court decided the Hazelwood case that we'll talk about later on.
Okay, we'll talk about it. Let's try to do it in order. So about 17 years after Tinker, after the black armband case, and after a shift in the court, what happened in the Frazier case?
So the Frazier case involves that very captive audience setting. It involves a young man who gets up in front of a school student government assembly where they're gathered to nominate and elect candidates. And in giving the nominating speech for one of his friends, he decides he's going to have some fun with the audience, and he's going to use this string of sexual double entendres.
Oh,
where
boy.
He refers to,
leave it to a 15-year-old kid to do that, you know, a teenage boy. He's going to... I can imagine this very easily happening at my old high school. But go on, please.
Sure. I can pick out some suspects in my high school.
Yes, indeed.
Might have been responsible.
Yes, we
that.
Know exactly who would pull something like this. Okay, so he gets up there and he starts swearing a blue streak.
Yeah. It wasn't actually swear words. It's a little more clever than that. He uses double entendres, but they're very thinly disguised double entendres.
Uh-huh.
He talks about how firm Jeff is in his pants and things
geez.
Like that. So he doesn't use any of George Carlin's words you can't say on the radio, but he comes close and he hints around at it, and he certainly has the desired effect. There are some people whooping and laughing in the audience, and it sort of breaks the otherwise austere mood that's supposed to accompany a student government election, and so he's disciplined for his conduct at the assembly, and relying on the Tinker case, he takes his case to the federal court. It gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Chief Justice Berger himself writes the majority opinion, which denies Matthew Frazier's First Amendment challenge to the discipline, and says that that was in fact not constitutionally protected speech.
And part of that was because it was a captive audience, which, as you pointed out, at least in a public school with mandatory attendance requirements, has to be there. So you have to protect those people's rights as well. But was there also partly the rationale that the schools have to have the ability to keep good order?
Very much so. I mean, when you read that opinion, you see, contrary to Justice Fortas's emphasis on students as citizens and this skepticism that he expresses of government regulation of content, what you see is Justice Berger's concern for keeping good order and inculcating good behavior in young people. And so he sees very much the role of the school as a teacher of kind of best behavioral practices being paramount, and the need for that punitive authority as part of inculcating the values of being a good citizen. And so he retreats some from Taker, and even acknowledging that the speech in the Frazier case did not rise to the level of disrupting the operations of the school, which is what the court sort of drew as the line of demarcation at Tinker, regardless of whether it actually disrupted good order in the school, because of the just lewdness and vulgarity of the language, it still was a punishable offense and it fell outside the boundaries of the First Amendment.
Okay, so we've at least put some kind of, we started out with this very sort of Warren Court 60s era concern about student freedom. And now we've gone to a more traditional, more conservative concern with good order and inculcating proper citizenship in schools. Right. And that brings us up to the Hazelwood case in the 1980s.
Right. So the Hazelwood case was decided 25 years ago. It's a 1988 ruling by the court. And interestingly, it was a light bench. It was a bench that was down to 8 members of the court. This was the Robert Bork controversy year, the seat that Justice Kennedy would eventually in time come to be nominated for and to hold. But at the time, it was a light bench of 8 justices. And just to sort of set the scene in Hazelwood, what was going on, this is the one and only high school newspaper case ever to get to the United States Supreme Court. There was a high school in the St. Louis area, Hazelwood East High School. The newspaper was called The Spectrum. The students there decided to write a package of stories that probably by contemporary standards in 2013 would look pretty tame and pretty run-of-the-mill to us, but at the time were considered kind of racy. There was a story about what it was like to be a child in a broken family where the father had divorced the mother. There was a story about teen pregnancy. There was a story that referenced contraception, and it was kind of a big package of stories about social issues that were of concern to teenagers. And one of the stories interviewed anonymously some young women who had been pregnant, talking about that experience, talking about their contraception use or lack of use. Another story interviewed the students from broken homes. It anonymized these students, but in the principal's view, did not anonymize them sufficiently. He felt that an alert reader could probably figure out which families were being talked about here, and he was concerned about that. And more broadly, was concerned that some of the content was just too mature for the youngest readers in high school. And so he calls up the printing company and tells them, I want you to yank those 2 pages out of the paper. And the paper comes out missing 2 pages. Well, the student editors, being aware of their rights under the Tinker case, take the school to court.
Well, I wonder what happens in this fascinating case. I know, but you'll have to wait a week to find out. Sorry about that. But hey, you've got part 2 to look forward to. Part 2 of Facebook, Public Schools, and Free Speech. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
Ever stop? Cute versus sexy, colors represent me. Freak is what's this? Now that really takes the piece. Oh no, fuck me, another fortune cookie. Texas, hold 'em, I think I'm gonna.